This episode of the Squawker Talker is brought to you by Beer 52. Beer 52 is the world's number one craft beer club and delivers crates of hand-picked craft beer to your door. Squawker Talker listeners can get £12 off a crate and two free beers by using the code SQUAWKER at checkout. So if you like a good deal on beer, visit beer52.com. Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. I join me today to look at a busy weekend's worth of action today in the FA Cup and all around Europe, plus looking forward to the Champions League and Europa League games in midweek is Mohamed Bub.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Pretty good.
George Ellick is here as well. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm okay.
You were up at Middlesbrough this weekend, weren't you, for the Oxford game?
I was. Sure, we'll talk about that in a bit.
We'll get on to it shortly. Yeah. That might not have produced the shock that maybe some people expected it to, but there certainly were plenty of giant-killing actions going on in the weekend. Lincoln obviously beat Burnley away at Turf Moor, a result we don't hear often, even in the Premier League. It's a poor game, but a great result. Lincoln made history, first non-league side in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup in 103 years. First time in their history, in their 133-year history, that they've reached the sixth round of the competition. They're now in the running for three trophies, the National Premier, the FA Trophy, and the FA Cup, although it's unlikely
Lincoln
they're
Treble,
win
man,
that one.
Coming at you.
Lincoln Treble, it could happen. I mean, Leicester won the Premier League last season. Who knows? Antonio Conte said it could never happen in Italy. We've also had a few questions, mainly from Melancholy Wolf on Twitter. Great name there. basically, he's getting bored of the cliches and the kind of the silly narratives we spin from these things. Conte says it couldn't happen in Italy. Another kind of, I guess, admission of romance there. But if you actually look into Lincoln, that they have a very sophisticated video analysis set up. They go into all their games, apparently, looking at all these videos, and they say it's as thorough and as complete as anything in the Football League and in the Premier League. So is this actually maybe a victory of facts over fantasy?
Well, I mean, if Melancholy Wolf's getting bored of the rhetoric, I'm getting bored of people talking about the FA Cup being dead and how boring it is. And I mean, this is absolutely unbelievable. This is what football's all about. I despaired yesterday when the draw was made and everyone got really excited about Chelsea United because, yeah, it'll be a good spectacle, but at the same time, it's the FA Cup. You know, it's a Premier League game, basically, and it's in the quarterfinals. Maybe if it was the final, it would be better. I think the story here, Lincoln's story, is absolutely superb. This is what it's all about. Burnley played a strong team as well. Danny Cowley, who's the Lincoln manager, for those who don't know much about him, he was a PE teacher. He wasn't a player. He was manager of Concord Rovers, then got his big move to Braintree. And at Braintree, when he was joint manager there, he went on to Lincoln this season. He's completely turned them around. You know, they're going for promotion here. And this is a manager who, despite people's somewhat snobbery about lower league football and about non-league football, he's someone who will undoubtedly manage at a much higher level and will probably grace, you know, the championship at least in the coming years. And it's this idea that these teams are very weak and they're very poor that is just frustrating, because I think they've shown consistently in the FA Cup this season that the pool of talent in the lower leagues and in non-leagues is actually very good. As you mentioned, the preparation that these teams do in order to get results like this is immense. And these are professionally run clubs, the players who are able to carry out the instructions that they're given. And the longer that the arrogance about that these teams should naturally defeat these clubs is a shame, and I'm glad that this season it's being turned on its head.
It's quite nice as well that, I mean, there's a lot of other big teams in the competition rotated their squads, whereas Lincoln put out there they're pretty much their strongest team, and then they all said, well, we've got to focus on Tuesday.
Celebration on to Tuesday. You know, that's a great attitude. It's a winning attitude. I think that's part of why they were able to do this to Burnley, you know. I mean, and also the fact that Joe Barton plays for Burnley.
Yeah,
under 400 completed passes in the game, which is the lowest I've ever seen in England, and it just shows that they came with a plan. They stopped Burnley from playing. I mean, Burnley, for all their faults at home, they're an effective, good team who do actually kind of move the ball around a fair bit as well. So, I mean, massive, massive congrats to them. I really, really hope that they. I think it's a great draw for them in the next round, because they're either going to get their big day at Arsenal, or they're going to have a winnable tie if Sutton do the unthinkable and get through. And again, that's another game where Arsenal fans are just assuming it's going to be a walk in the park,
which
I don't think it will be.
Which brings us on to tonight's fixture. We're recording on Monday. Monday night sees Sutton host Arsenal in another romantic, fantastical FA Cup tie. We've seen and heard all the jokes about Arsenal pulling off a shock of their own to beat Sutton, but are the Gunners really at risk of anything negative happening to them? They're going to win this one, surely, aren't they?
They might get injuries. That they are with the 3G pitch, they might suffer some injuries. It's Arsenal, after all. I mean, they suffer injuries on perfect grass pitches. Then, you know, God knows on a 3G pitch what's going to happen to them.
Danny Welbeck did say he's not going to be involved.
Welbeck won't play. And I mean, they might actually miss him because he's the cup hero. He's the guy who can get it done in the big games. Look, man, Arsenal, if you know, they should destroy them. They should win, even with that pitch, even without Alexis Sanchez and Danny Welbeck, they should win this game comfortably. But I don't know if they will, because Sutton have a very solid game plan. They have a really defined way of playing, and they could definitely, you know, if they come at it and Arsenal are even a little bit complacent, it's going to be so weird. It's been like a training game or like their preseason game at Brentford every season. There's been like tiny, tiny ground. They've got like 5 press seats.
I think the main difference compared to a preseason game or a training game is that Sutton aren't going to give them a second on the ball. If this was at the Emirates, it would be a different story. I mean, the fact is that Sutton, with this pitch, I mean, Maidstone are another team with a plastic pitch in the non-league, and they have exactly the same thing, where their home record is absolutely tremendous and their away form is very poor, because these teams, you know, they train on this pitch. It's second nature to them. The bounce of the ball, the roll of the ball, that's, you know, it's how they play. Whereas for Arsenal, they don't. They train on grass. They play on grass. It's a different... It's almost a different sport. It's a massive leveller.
But we almost talk about this dismissive, like the plastic pitch, in inverted commas. But it meets all of FIFA's stringent pro standard level kind of regulations. I know they're not allowed in the Football League and the Premier League yet. We talked about Lincoln's manager and the interesting use of video technology there. But Sutton, their manager's actually given the club, a £500,000 loan to buy this pitch. And he's not really any rush to get the money paid back to him. And there's been loads of talk. I think Jack Pitbrook in The Independent wrote a story today about how it's been a boon to like the local kind of football scene. Everyone's getting involved. It's been great for the club. So, I mean, is it an unfair advantage, or...
It's no more an unfair advantage than general home advantages. You know, if Arsenal were playing at home, then they'd have 55,000 fans cheering them on. Is that an unfair advantage? You know, if it passes the regulations, then there's absolutely no reason for them not to have it. And a quick plug for Sutton as well. If you do, I've been speaking to someone at the club, if you do want to rent out their pitch after seeing it live on TV tonight, you can. I think it's £300.
Wow.
And you can rent it out for an 11-a-side game, which is, you know, pretty good thing to do.
I mean, it's the same thing as playing at altitude. You know, it should they just not play there, because that's where their home ground is. So that's the home advantage, you know. And people talk about home advantage always levels itself out. Like, if you get so used to playing like certain conditions at home, then you struggle away from home in different conditions. It's like domed teams in the NFL. You know, they play brilliantly in domes, and then they can really struggle outdoors.
So are you saying that Sutton have the Bolivian principle in their favour? Is that the...
La Paz, yeah. The La Paz nice. Principle.
There's no doubt, obviously, just to, I mean, because obviously I am saying that Sutton have a chance. If Arsenal turn up, they'll win. You know, if Arsenal play well, they'll win. I'm not denying
but
that.
But Arsenal aren't in any great shakes at the moment, are they?
No, they're not, of course. But, you know, their talent is... You know, someone who's watched a fair bit of these lower league teams against Premier League clubs, the difference is obviously just the chance conversion is just immense. You know, Sutton could stay in the game for half an hour, I think they've got a chance, and then someone like Lucas Perez gets a sniff of a chance and it's 1-0. That is the difference. All I'm saying is that surely we've seen already in this FA Cup that Arsenal fans who are going into tonight assuming it's going to be an easy win just maybe should temper their expectations a wee bit and just understand that they won't have it all their own way.
But their next game in all competitions is Liverpool on March the 4th. So we've got a big long wait for the next game, which means that Wenger can go with his full strength side, doesn't it, Mo?
He can do. I don't know if he will, but I think Wenger's one of the few managers who's always very, very consciously aware of injuries. He's hesitant. He doesn't overplay players. He learned his lesson with Thierry Henry with that, where he overplayed him and in the end told him to Barcelona, you know, sort of a broken guy physically. So I don't think he'll be coached. Alexis Sanchez obviously has got his holiday. He's not going to play. Danny Welbeck said he's not going to play. I don't know who he'll play. He should put out his first team 11 and absolutely wallop Sutton and really get some momentum back into Arsenal season. I don't know that he will.
Because he needs to, doesn't he? I mean, all the talk at the moment is Wenger's future. I mean, how much would an FA Cup win mean to him this season? I mean, would it be enough? He didn't retire for the last two.
I mean, there'd be something very poetic about Wenger playing his first team against Sutton and resting players against Bayern Munich in the Champions League next week, but in a couple of weeks' time. But yeah, it's huge. It's basically their only chance of success now. And I think that whilst the past two FA Cup wins haven't been enough to see Wenger leave on a high, I think now it's all getting a bit rotten there. The squad he had a couple of years ago, I think he thought was good enough to win the Premier League. And now the likes of Ozil and Sanchez dropping out, I think he'd probably still like to leave.
Steve Williams, across the keeper on Twitter, asks, could Wenger really stay on for another 4 years? And what would that say about Arsenal as a club if he did?
Of course he could. Ben, what would it say? It's just, it would say that Arsenal are happy settling for mediocrity. They're comfortable in what they are, and they are too in the thrall of a man who revolutionised English football and revolutionised Arsenal, but did that 20 years ago. And is now not...
Well,
not
15.
The, 15. 15. Okay, 15. And is now not the manager, not the manager that he once was. And you know, that time moves on. Father Time is undefeated, both for players and for managers. And, you know, even caught up with Fergie, who's probably the greatest manager or one of the greatest managers of all time. It happens, man. So Wenger should be moved on. If he stays, it just shows that Arsenal are happy to settle for mediocrity.
Mm. If Wenger were to go elsewhere, where could, would, should he go, George?
I have a feeling that was just a bargaining chip when he said he was going to manage somewhere next season. I think that's just a way of him saying to the Arsenal board, I'm not going to take your director of football cushy office job if I do leave. And maybe a way of him trying to keep his job.
He should take that, though. I think he'd be a brilliant director of football.
But is it kind of like one of those Hollywood detectives where it's like, you're off the case, sticking behind a desk job now. He's like, no, boss. Yeah. Give him a badge and my gun. I'm going back out there to solve crime. That's kind of where Wenger's at, isn't it?
I mean,
he's the last detective. That's for one last big job, one big case.
Considering his, you know, he managed in Japan before Arsenal, you wouldn't be surprised to see him move to one of those, one of the club, maybe in China or maybe somewhere in the East. He's lived there. He's lived in Japan before. And I'm sure there'd be a few lucrative offers from some leagues that don't know much about in Europe.
Mm. If let's say he does get beaten by Sutton, I mean, what would that do?
I mean, that's honestly, I mean, that would be gold for Arsenal Fan TV.
It'd be a bit of a tragedy, wouldn't it?
It would be hilarious in many ways for people that don't like Arsenal to laugh at them, but it would be very sad. It would be very sad to see, because honestly, you want Arsenal, at this point, I mean, everyone except Spurs fans basically wants Arsenal to go on a high. You know, win the FA Cup and just retire. He should have done it 2 years ago, didn't do it, whatever. You know, no one wants to see it. It's kind of sad at this point, really.
Mm-hmm. George alluded to it earlier, and we're going to move on now to what, I mean, a lot of people are going to call the tie of the round because it's two big heavyweights up against each other. Chelsea versus Manchester United. Chelsea beat Wolves away 2-0 this weekend, while United went away to Blackburn and won 2-1. But Conte and Mourinho named rotated teams. But whose second string did the better job, and what could that mean for their showdown in the sixth round?
Oh, Chelsea's did by far, because they won the game. United needed to bring on Ibrahimovic and Pogba to win the game. Chelsea, they did better.
I mean, what's Pedro and Diego Costa scored their goals?
Yeah, look, they had to work, but I mean, you know, they didn't need rescuing. Yeah, okay, sure, the better player scored the goal, but like, United start with Pogba, with Mkhitaryan and Martial and Rashford. Like, those guys could have won the game. Rashford scored the equaliser. Very nice. Took it round the goalkeeper, Ronaldo style. Love you, Rashford. That was fantastic. More players need to do that. But no, United needed the big guns on to bail them out. Chelsea didn't need to make any big changes. And I mean, maybe that speaks to the way Conte set his team out in the first place. You know, actually more a better balanced team, but no, Conte's team did better. I don't know what it means for them. I think they both go first, full teams in the FA Cup match. They'll both go all guns blazing. There's no way Conte wants to lose Mourinho. He's already started the needling in the press. He will give everything to beat Conte in the FA Cup. There's no way he wants to lose that.
Just a bit of praise for Cesc Fabregas again. I mean, whenever he plays for Chelsea this season, he just looks absolutely brilliant. He's almost like he's in top form, but he's never playing. There was one ball through to Willian, which he played, which was just absolutely phenomenal. You know, if you're talking about second string teams and you've got Cesc Fabregas playing in centre midfield, then I think that's going to be a tall order for anyone to get over. He's still an elite footballer and probably one of the best ball playing centre midfielders in the world.
But speaking of ball playing centre midfielders, Pogba wasn't half bad when he came on as well. He delivered a wonderful pass to Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And in the past, on these pods, we've talked about how that connection maybe hasn't been as efficient as it should be. Pogba's laid things on the plate, and Ibrahimovic has missed a few big chances, most notably against Liverpool and Hull. But Ibrahimovic, I should say, now has 24 goals in 36 games at the age of 35. He scored 32% of United's goals in all competitions, 40% in the league. If you include assists as well, he's actually been responsible for 50% of their goals in the league this season. However, Steve Williams, back again, has asked, since he's also missed 13 clear-cut chances so far, how many goals can he score this season, and what the numbers underneath this record really say about his quality, George?
I think he could score loads more, really. He's someone who's obviously very good at getting into goal-scoring positions, which is half the battle. The fact he's missed 13 clear-cut chances, for me, would suggest he's going to score more rather than less. I mean, his finishing, we've seen over the past 15 years is absolutely superb. He's a you know, great marksman.
I always think he doesn't always master the poacher moments, but he pulls amazing goals out of nowhere. He often seems to enjoy scoring the harder chances.
Part of the problem he has with easy chances is he likes to smack the ball hard, you just see him winding the shot up. And
you don't often see him score a scrappy or a weak goal, do you?
And it just makes it easier for defenders.
His hat trick against Saint-Étienne.
Well, that's true.
No, but, that's the thing. A lot of times when he's put one on one with the goalkeeper, he likes to wallop it in, and the keeper has a chance to see what he's going to do because he's so big. His wind up is so enormous. Like, if he was more a fan of the toe poke of the casual side foot, he'd score more goals. He'd score more of the clear cut chances. Instead, he just tries to whack it right in the top corner. And that, sometimes when you're one on one, that's not the way to go.
I think a crucial thing now is that this United team is really clicking into gear, and with Martial coming into the team as well, I think he's only going to get more chances, because he was dropping very deep at times earlier in the season because United weren't really functioning too well. He was having to collect the ball kind of outside of his own area. Whereas now, I think it's just basically, the system is built around giving him the ball and the goal scoring opportunities, so he could still get a hatful.
The goal yesterday was a perfect example of what we're talking about. Like, Rat made a great run into space, behind into space, destroyed the offside trap, and then just waited, and really just like delicate, just like guided finish into the far corner of the net. I mean, there's more to come. He'll top 30 goals this season, no question about it.
Mm. And Rashford obviously got the opener. We're going to come on to them a little bit later on when we talk about the second leg of their Europa League tie later in the pod. But just return to Chelsea one second. Diego Costa scored his first Chelsea goal for 430 minutes of football against Wolves. Will he kick on now after a lean patch, or is he slowing down a little bit like he did in 2015?
It's hard to say at the moment. I think, again, he's kind of the victim of his own success somewhat, because he was scoring at such a ridiculous rate. We've said on the pod before that if you look at the expected goals of his chances, he was way, way ahead. He was just running very hot. So it's not a surprise to see him somewhat kind of go back into a normal routine. But at the same time, so long as Chelsea are functioning as they are, they're just a winning machine. So long as he's leading the line for that team, he'll continue to score goals. I'd be very surprised if he had a seriously barren run from here on in.
Well, I mean, obviously, they're likely to be two of the players, to decide the tie for their teams with their goal records. But where else, when they come and meet, will Chelsea and United be matched up quite well? I mean, you look at the team sheets, and maybe, as you said, like Fabregas versus Pogba for the creative passes, Hazard versus Mkhitaryan for those absolute game changers, or maybe even Martial and Pedro for those kind of auxiliary threats attack. Where do we see the match being won?
Cesc Fabregas versus Ander Herrera and Paul Pogba versus N'Golo Kante. That's where the match will be won. If United's midfield duo, because it probably be a duo, he'll probably throw Fellaini in there, but Fellaini will be used, I would imagine,
I don't know. Do you reckon he will play Fellaini?
Yes, and I was about to tell you why. I think that midfield duo is going to be key, but I think the other thing that's going to be key is I think he'll play, because I think if you look at Chelsea, their big obvious weakness is the right-hand side of their defence in the air. And you can just see Mourinho doing it immediately, playing Fellaini as a number 10 and just spending the entire game Pogba, Herrera, Valencia just woofting crosses over from the right.
Lofting.
It's a great word.
Lofting, whatever. Just woofting crosses into the air for Cesar Azpilicueta and Victor Moses to defend, and Fellaini and Zlatan Ibrahimovic, gigantic human beings, just destroying Chelsea at the far post.
Does that mean that we need to see a bit more Kurt Zouma then?
I mean, this is what I'm saying. I think if Conte is smart, he'll get Zouma fit and in rhythm before that game, because he'll be essential.
I'm sure that Zouma will play that game. I think that the rest of this season is just going to be getting him back fit and back playing, ready to come into that right-hand side of defence role next season. Just a word on the Fabregas-Pogba matchup that you mentioned. Obviously, Pogba, and for many, many attributes, is a better fit. He's a better midfielder than Fabregas, including his athleticism and his dribbling and his pace and his strength. But there's absolutely no contest for me in terms of their kind of long-range creative ability. Paul Pogba gets away with so much because of who he is, in that, even the Saint-Étienne game midweek, people talk about him running the midfield, but the amount of times, if you look at his pass maps, the amount of times he puts balls over the top that are just poor, poor long balls, they're either going straight to a defender or straight out of play. If other players did it, they'd get absolutely canned. Fabregas is an absolute master of knowing when to play the ball and pulling it off. So whilst I'm not saying that Fabregas is a better player than Pogba, obviously, I think that in terms of long-range creative talent, there's only one winner.
Yeah, I think what you have there is a 23-year-old and a 30-year-old, basically.
Of course, quite clearly.
And I think, one thing I will say about Pogba is sometimes I think he thinks he's already playing with Antoine Griezmann. Like, some of the passes he plays, like, Zlatan is not going to reach that ball, Paul. What are you doing? But yeah, we'll see.
Another defender that might be quite interesting for that battle is Nathan Ake, who played at centre back against Wolves, played at wing back for against Brentford, very good in both games. So maybe if Zouma does come in and they need to have another ball player, because Cahill's not quite Aspilicueta Greta in that regard. Could we see Ake come in as well? Did we see in the weekend a bit of an audition for Chelsea's second string defenders and how they could come in the future?
I think Cahill's very good in the air. I think he'll be retained.
Well, he's 6'4", isn't he?
Yeah. I think it just depends. We don't know yet because of Chelsea have had a very, very cushy run of games to this stage of the competition. We just don't have any idea how seriously Antonio Conte is taking it. He's put out teams that are somewhat weakened, but also very much able to win these games. And I think the playing of Costa against Wolves signifies that he may revert back to a stronger team. I think Zouma will be the one who will play, but except for that, I think we might see Chelsea's strongest team come out against United.
Interesting. We were talking there about the weakness in the air that Chelsea have at the back. Obviously, the side that exploited that to the highest of their abilities were Spurs through Dele Alli with two headed goals to beat them at White Hart Lane. But there'll be another Battle of London in the FA Cup sixth round. Spurs have drawn Millwall. A lot of Spurs fans joking that the demolition costs on White Hart Lane when they build a new stadium will now be reduced because Millwall will come up and do the job for them. Millwall beat Leicester City despite going 10 men down for the best part of 40 minutes. And Spurs are extremely professional in dispatching Fulham, a side that we all thought might cause them a little bit of trouble. 3-0 for a Harry Kane hat-trick. Richard Osman, you may know him from Pointless, the famous daytime TV show, game show, whatever you want to call it, said on the BBC, actually, he was very disappointed that Spurs actually showed the cup the respect it deserves. he wanted to see a weakened side so Fulham could have a go at it. But Poch's side looked better, once again, playing in their 4-2-3-1, but with Harry Winks in the middle. But everything seems to work better when Harry Kane's on the pitch doing what he does, scoring goals, doesn't he? How important is he, and is that a weakness?
He's essential, and it is a weakness because he's their only goal scorer. Like, he's the only guy who can consistently score goals, especially when they play 4-2-3-1.
He does more than score goals, though, doesn't he?
No, he defines the shape of their team. He's a brilliant lead forward. I mean, you saw his goals were the first two, especially, were just classic striker play, capitalizing on Christian Eriksen. Even the third, he's a really, really good all-around striker. He doesn't have searing pace. If he did, he'd be world-class. He doesn't have searing pace, but, you know, he's fantastic for what they need. It's a weakness because he's the only player that scores goals. Like, to be fair, though, part of the Dele Alli thing is I think he really needs to be playing in the 3-4-2-1. He needs that play in the half space where he can really just not touch the ball at all. Like, he was getting to a lot of good positions yesterday because he was doing it from a really obviously central area. He wasn't
Dele Doiter.
Yeah, well, exactly. He wasn't fast. Eriksen, I thought, was brilliant yesterday. He played ostensibly on the right before 4-2-3-1, but he really just played where he would normally play in the 3-4-2-1 in the half space, moving in and out of spaces and created the first two goals. Really, really, really good performance from him. You're talking about Harry Winks. Harry Winks was key. For the 4-2-3-1 normally this season looked very stodgy because Dembele hasn't been in that sort of scintillating form he was in last season.
Even last season, I saw a lot of Spurs fans saying that in itself is a weakness. It's like a choke point in the team.
And now with Winks in there, Winks actually passed the ball, moved it around very well and looked very comfortable in that role. And I think that allowed the 4-2-3-1 to not be stodgy. But Vertonghen is back now, so I suspect we'll see a return to the 3-4-2-1 very quickly.
And that was the first time that I've really thought Harry Winks looked the real deal yesterday. I've seen him in the past and there were performances that kind of reminded me of Ryan Mason and Tom Carroll's bursting onto the scene where it looked very tidy but not really much going on from there. But yesterday he kind of took the game by the scruff of the neck somewhat. He kept dropping deep to collect the balls off Vertonghen and the other defenders from deep areas and driving forward with it and using it very sensibly. On the back of that performance, he looks like someone who could definitely be, because I still have issues with the midfield two of Wanyama and Dembele just in terms of their off the ball kind of athleticism, whereas he's someone who can certainly do that. He's happy to get stuck in, and on the basis of that performance yesterday, I think he's a special talent and someone I'm going to look forward to watching more.
Well, we may see him up against Millwall. It depends what Pochettino decides to do with his team selection. But Millwall could yet make the playoffs in League One. But what is it that's made them more proficient as giant killers in the FA Cup this season? In fact, we talked about Sutton, we've talked about Lincoln and their kind of unusual and unique advantages with their video technology and their pitch and all that kind of stuff. But what factors off the field have driven Millwall to the performances they've had? Will they be able to pull off a shock at White Hart Lane, or has home advantage at the New Den really been vital for them?
I think home advantage has been absolutely massive for them. Their draws have been, take nothing away from them because what they've done has been absolutely fantastic. But they drew Bournemouth at a time where Bournemouth were conceding three goals every game. they then drew Watford, who have come off the back of a couple of poor results. And then they drew Leicester, who, to be frank, didn't want to be there. Aren't all at home. And I think what's happening off the pitch with the stadium has obviously galvanised them and unified them as well. This could be a bridge too far. But at the same time, Millwall are in somewhat of a false position in League One. They should be higher. Their performances and the kind of expected goals data suggests they should be their performances and the expected goals data suggest they should be kind of well into the playoff mix as opposed to kind of just outside of it. So I thought that Fulham would give Spurs a good game, but they couldn't live with Spurs' high intensity and their press. They'd probably be the same here, I'd have thought.
Moving on now to Middlesbrough, who we don't know who they're going to be playing in the sixth round yet, because Manchester City and Huddersfield held out for a 0-0 draw. Huddersfield, another side that Mr. George Ellick has tipped for you know, for big things, and said they might be a bit trouble, and they did prove a bit of trouble. But Ita Karanka's side beat Oxford 3-2 in a dramatic encounter at, well, up in the northeast. How was it? You were there?
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible cup tie. Both sets of fans were just amazing. I think Middlesbrough, without a doubt, are the best Premier League fans I've ever heard, and that was for a cup game against Oxford, which is, you know, a testament to them. They went 2-0 up and probably could have been 4 or 5-0 up at half time, to be honest. They absolutely dominated Oxford. And then Oxford scored twice in 52 seconds, which is a moment that I will never forget, although it's slightly tainted now because Christian Suani scored with 5 minutes to go.
Was it the hope that killed? Was it one of those kind of situations?
I still can't really get over it, to be fair.
There can be no true despair without hope.
It was the frustrating thing, really, I think, from an Oxford point of view, is that in the second half, at 2-2, Oxford looked like the team who would likely go on and win the game. And I think if you'd offered it the Middlesbrough fans then the replay, probably, I mean, I'm sure Aitor Cranker wouldn't have wanted to replay, but I think just in terms of staying in the competition, they'd have taken it. And all it took was Alvaro Negredo to come on and a lovely touch of his, kind of doing a bicycle kick assist to Stuani at the back post, and that was that.
Staff and Middlesbrough could do more with more in the Premier League as well, isn't it? Really?
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. This looked to all that like it would probably be a kind of a goal would nick it here or there, and then you know, they don't concede many, and Oxford score two, and they don't score many, and Oxford don't concede many, and they score three. I'm sure that they'll do okay. I think this is now, I still think they'll stay up. So I think that the FA Cup now represents a decent chance for them. But from an Oxford point of view, it was pretty heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Man City, meanwhile, maybe they were the side people would expect to beat a Leicester team 3-2. It actually ended 0-0 with a David Wagner's side holding City back, who had the most of the chances, the shots, and all the rest of it. Sergio Aguero came back into side with Gabriel Jesus potentially out for the season. Can Pep, we talked about how Guardiola's improvements with Gabriel Jesus up front, it's all started to click. Can they survive with Aguero coming back into the team? Or is that a bit unfair to pin this on him?
No, they can't survive. This is going to hurt them severely because Aguero, as we've said before, is just not a fit for Guardiola's system. The ball goes up to him and then just immediately comes back. He can't hold off defenders. He can't hold the ball up. His movement is fine. His goal scoring is fine. They'll still pound to make teams. They'll smash Huddersfield in the replay. Aguero will score a hat-trick, probably.
Why doesn't Guardiola just change then?
Well, because why should he change? His system,
he hasn't got the player to play.
His system is the way his team plays. And, you know, the unwavering belief in that system is part of what makes his team so strong. It's part of what allows him to overcome opponents like pressing them or harassing them.
But that hasn't happened this season. So why doesn't he just say, we'll come back to that next season when Gabriel Jesus is fit? Because we've got Sergio Aguero. What are we going to do with him?
Because he's an idealist. Because that's how he is. If he changes his ways, and, you know, for him, that would be like, there's no point in football then. If I've got to do things my way, well, there's no point in doing it. He's very idealistic in that way, and you know, that's just how he is. He's worked for him so far, hasn't he?
Idealistic?
It,
so. Grumpy? That sounds a bit of a cop.
I just want to put on record that I think that City won't smash Huddersfield in the replay, just to get that out there.
Huddersfield played a week inside, didn't they? They rotated their own players, basically their reserves.
Yeah. To be fair, if he plays Jesus Navas, they probably won't smash him.
Is it Kachunga that's there?
Kachunga, yeah.
Kachunga, yeah. I mean, I was watching the game over, well, not all of it, I was watching it along with other matches, and they, especially towards the end, they had about three chances where his selfishness on the ball or his poor decision making meant that a clear open shot and goal that if he would have played it to somebody else didn't quite happen. They could have won it at the death.
I mean, I think they'd be hard pressed to find people who just said they probably didn't deserve to win it by the end of it. I think that with Huddersfield, similar to Guardiola, I mean, their manager David Wagner has a very clear idea of how he wants his teams to play, and I think we saw in this game that despite the fact that these players aren't necessarily the ones who play week in week out, they've been drilled and they know their job. Like Dean Whitehead, who's a, you know, a 35-year-old veteran centre midfielder, has been, you know, transformed into this kind of incredible passing player by Wagner late on in his career. And it's just testament to what he's done at that club. I mean, they're going to be in the Premier League next season, I hope. I think that they should win the playoffs and I think they'll give everyone a shot because the way they're playing, their potential is absolutely massive. And the improvement of the players, not only has he recruited very well and brought in players from Europe who are very good, the improvement in players who are already there is incredible. I mean, Jonathan Hogg was a player who was already there when he came in, and I actually tweeted a stat before the weekend's games, which upset quite a few Barcelona fans, which I couldn't really understand. That
they're not in a good way at the moment.
Hogg and Moy have completed 100. They average 128 passes completed per game, which is more than Rakitic and Iniesta combined. It's more than Cruz and Modric combined.
That's amazing.
I'm obviously not suggesting that they're better than them, but it's just testament to the style of football that they're playing.
Can I imagine when Swansea came up and people comparing their passing stats to Barcelona?
Yeah.
Like, it kind of shows that the Football League isn't just the home of, you know,
well, that's exactly it. So when one Barcelona fan replied to me saying that's like comparing three-legged donkeys with Ferraris, and I was like, well, I'm not comparing them as players. It's just
if a three-legged donkey can pull off the better horsepower than a Ferrari, that's worth noting.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. And also these players, you know, Aaron Moy, who obviously couldn't play against City, against his parents' club, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he steps into their squad next season. He's a really, really talented player. He's the kind of player who I think Pep likes because he can sit deep whilst he's a very good ball-playing player, but he can also do the defensive work well. He'd come in as kind of a replacement for Delph and someone who could ably deputise for Fernandinho. He could probably play that inverted wing-back role as well.
I mean, they really need someone deep in midfield as well. Yaya Toure is not the one.
I thought he was the one. A couple of weeks ago, I said
this is the best position for him in City's system. I didn't say he was great in it. He's good in it. He's serviceable. This is basically the thing he can do the best without. When he plays in central midfield, he actively harms the team.
Well, speaking of serviceable options, El Harazi on Twitter says, Iheanacho is future at Man City, and I've added this bin, is the alternative option in case of a replay, especially with Aguero maybe not quite cutting it in Pep's system, though?
You know, the thing is, they played their best football prior to Gabriel Jesus. They played the best football this season with Iheanacho up front in that run when Aguero was suspended for four games in like way back in the start of autumn.
Pep subbed him quite a lot, though. I don't think he was too happy with Iheanacho himself in that role.
I mean, he worked. He did very well against, I mean, United, for instance, at Old Trafford. But I don't know. But yeah, he's not really featured much second half of the season. Now, knowing Pep, look at his history and what the way he's tended to do things, what that generally means is he's not training very well. When a player just disappears off the map like that one does, and Iheanacho is very talented, we know this, it means he's not cutting it in training and Guardiola's unhappy with something. So I think Iheanacho should come in. I think he's a better fit for than Aguero is, especially in big games where you want something tactical rather than just pure goal power against weaker teams. I don't know if he will. If he's not playing, he's really just not featured much at all. I think he might need a loan out. I mean, if he's not, you know, you would assume it's something going wrong if he's not training well enough or whatever, he's unhappy, but... I think he should come in. I don't know if Pep will bring him in, though.
How much does Pep need to win the FA Cup? We talked about Wenger, Poch, Mourinho. Those guys all shooting for a trophy. How much does Pep need to win some silverware in his first season?
I don't think too much. His job is as secure as it could be. I think he could finish anywhere and he'd keep his job. So for that reason, not so much. Obviously, I'm sure he'd like to win the FA Cup and get that first bit of silverware. But I think we all know it's only a matter of time until he starts winning trophies there. So I wouldn't be too concerned for him if they did get knocked out.
Well, City have got Monaco in midweek, but we're going to get onto that a little bit later on. First, we're going to look at all the other action in Europe. Mo, I'm probably going to come to you first on this one. In La Liga, Barcelona beat Leganes. I do know how to say these things. 2-1 at home in front of a very dissenting Camp Nou crowd. There were boos. There were kind of rival cheers for Enrique. Boos for Enrique.
They whistled Andre Gomez like crazy.
Yeah, there's lots going on. Messi scored the opener and the winner. The winner being a penalty from the spot won by Neymar, who was absolutely cleared out in the box. But Messi didn't celebrate that. And okay, it's a little bit mischievous. Some people going, oh, maybe the problem isn't Luis Enrique's future. Maybe the problem is Lionel Messi's future, which I think was a little bit overplayed. Clearly, the whole stadium were unhappy. You're not, if you're a player, you're not going to probably be too happy with that either. Luis Enrique was booed. Messi wasn't happy, as I said. A club in crisis, or is this just all a bit overdramatic, all over the top from a Barcelona set of fans who aren't winning many friends at the moment with their kind of, you know, their reactions and their reputation isn't going too well.
It's a little from column A, a little from column B, frankly. Yeah, it is that Barca have a problem right now. Luis Enrique, I mean, I said...
They're second in the league. They're still in the Copa del Rey.
I said a week ago, you know, that Luis Enrique is doing fine, and he is. But then he's always had these games where he just picks weird team selections, weird tactics, and then does weird subs as well. And he's done it in the league, lost 4-1 to Celta Vigo, except lost 2-1 at home to Alaves, etc., etc. But what usually happens is it's in the league. That doesn't happen in the Cups. It happened in the Cup, in the Champions League. He picked a bad team, made bad substitutions, and PSG just absolutely blasted them out of the water, 4-0. You know,
his position's untenable now, isn't it?
No, no, he's going anyway. He was always like, oh, is he going to leave? He's probably going to leave. Oh, not sure.
Think he'll walk now?
Oh, he's going to walk. He's not going to renew his contract. It's clear. He's fed up. He's unhappy. He's never really liked the press anyway. I think he'd just love to win a trophy and just peace out into the sunset. I just think... You look at it, he's done this twice. And the reason Messi was so unhappy, not so much because of the... I mean, obviously the 4-1, 4-0 thing is still weighing on his mind. He was very bad against PSG. But Barca's system against Leganés was terrible. They scored after 4 minutes. And they should have won that game handily. But
Leganés
should have won the game. They were much better. Ter Stegen was Barca's second best player after Neymar. Produced loads of great saves.
Made that one mistake though, didn't he?
Well, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Isn't it typical? It's like he was playing so well, you're thinking, okay, he's gonna score and it's going to be a second mistake. And it was. But no, it just this Barcelona need to go back to midfield play. There was Denis Suarez didn't play. He's the only midfielder apart from Iniesta who looks like an actual midfielder.
You tweeted that they're just trying to play to the flanks, aren't they?
They're not bringing the ball through the middle. They were doing this earlier at the end of 2016, and you're thinking, okay, what's going on? Then Iniesta came back from injury, and everything was good for a little while. But now with Rakitic's poor form, which has been poor all season, Iniesta's injured, in and out of fitness again. Didn't play last week, even though he desperately needs fitness ahead of Atletico next week. They just had no midfield. The ball wasn't getting to Messi, Neymar, and Suarez in the best positions possible. And it was just the midfield play. Barca's midfield players point. Sergio Roberto is not a right back. They need to buy a right back. They need to make use of that La Liga loophole clause for injuries and sign a right back because Sergio Roberto ain't cutting it.
Well, let's say Luis Enrique does go. Who is going to replace him? The favourites are Sampaoli and Valverde from Athletic Club. Arsene Wenger? It's not really on the cards, is it?
Nah, it's not awesome. It's going to be... Sampaoli has a 1.5 million euro release clause from Sevilla's contract. It'll be Sampaoli. The press love him. He's proven that he can handle it in Europe. And Messi's a big fan. He flipping worships Messi. So it'll be... I would imagine it'll be Sampaoli.
Elsewhere in La Liga, Granada won 4-1 to keep their hopes of relegation survival.
I'm
going to
keep betting against Granada, by the way, because it's clearly working.
It's working for them. Especially their key rivals losing. I think everybody else in the bottom four lost, didn't they? There were 2-0 wins for Real Madrid, Sevilla and Valencia, who finally put in the sort of performance that probably non-regular Liga viewers, having known their reputation throughout the years, probably expect from them.
They're starting to get a bit better, and it's good to see. And it's going to make that tie one of Madrid's game in hand is against Valencia, and that's going to be much more interesting now than it was. But shout out to Real Madrid, Gareth Bale, back from injury, scored an absolutely wonderful goal. Just looks like he's, you know, I mean, his pace is frightening, and he's still frightening. And it's really good to see he's back from injury now. Hopefully, let's see he can go on and be influential and dynamic because he's a game changer for them. He really is.
Well, I think I did say in an earlier pod if Bale comes back, I'm probably going to put Real Madrid as one of the favourites for not only the Liga, which they're way ahead in, but also the Champions League. What a player to come back in. I know the whole, like a new signing, but Bale is such a player of such quality that having that just to return to a team already by hook or by crook doing well, that's going to give them a massive edge, isn't it,
without
George?
A doubt. I think he's their star attacker now. If he's back and fit and playing for them, especially with, it looks like Barcelona going out of the Champions League, so... And I'm still, I mean, I know we're about to talk about them, but I'm still not convinced at all by Bayern Munich in any way, shape or form, irrespective of a 5-1 victory over Arsenal.
Carlo Ancelotti, man. Carlo Ancelotti.
not for me. So, yeah, I mean, it would take a brave man to they aren't favourites, to be honest. Mm.
Well, moving to the Bundesliga now, ground was gained on Bayern after that ridiculous weekend where they were the only team in the top seven to win. But they could have actually dropped all 3 points. They drew away to Hertha, only Lewandowski equalising at the very death. Kept a point in it for Colin Schotty's side. Paul Dardar was very frustrated, hinted that he believed the Bavarians get an unfair advantage from the refs. I think he called it a Bayern bonus, or people interpreted what you're saying to that. Leipzig, Dortmund and Hoffenheim all won, while Hamburg gained another vital point with a 2-2 draw to keep crawling up the table towards safety. I don't think they actually moved any positions, but it's another point gained. It's what they need. But Ingolstadt too kept their slim chance of survival alive with a thumping away win at Frankfurt, another side doing very well this season otherwise. Wolfsburg on the other hand lost. They lost 3-0 to Dortmund. Should the Wolves be worried?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, it's a topsy-turvy league this season, the Bundesliga, and if these teams at the bottom do start picking up points. I mean, the issue is that they're surrounded by other teams who don't expect to be down there, really, which means that anyone, you know, the likes of Hamburg can just turn it on and go on a run, which could leave them in trouble. It's a huge result, though, for Leipzig this week. They'd obviously gone through a tough run of form, and they beat Mönchengladbach 2-1 away from home, going 2-0 up and just holding on to that win, which is massive. And it's just yet again evidence that this Bayern Munich team in the Bundesliga are just... so reliant on Lewandowski to bail them out of trouble. It's happening every week now, and they're not clicking, they're not playing well. It's an aging team who are so reliant on Thiago and Lewandowski to provide any kind of spark for them.
Why can't they play Arsenal every week, eh?
I know. Well, that's exactly it. I mean, that's what's so concerning for Arsenal fans is that, I mean, I know that Carlo Ancelotti obviously has a fantastic record in Europe, but I'm just not having that. They're not a good team. They're not the Bayern Munich that people think they are anymore. They've regressed massively under him, and I can't see them going far in the Champions League. And I think they will win the Bundesliga, mainly because Leipzig had that dodgy run of form.
Moving on now to Italy, Serie A. While the top four all won, the big stories this week came from a couple of plucky underdogs, although one's probably pluckier than the other, Pescara, with Zeman back in the dugout, the man who brought them back up into Serie A.
Zemanlandia, mate.
Absolutely. Basically gave Verratti the kind of platform to show how good he could become, and look where he's gone since. Won 5-0 against Genoa to land only their second win of the season. As you say, Zemanlandia is back, but surely it's a hiding to nothing.
Who knows?
Frankly, yeah, we've got 16 points or something.
Yeah, look, but I mean, look, one of the beautiful things about Zeman is just it's just fun to watch. Even if they go down, I mean, and they probably still will, it'll be great fun to watch. It'll be fun. In a just world, Zeman and Paco Jemez would be coaching two of the biggest clubs in the world and just thrilling the world over. But
well, Zeman did try at Roma recently. It didn't quite end too well. But Atalanta beat Crotone 1-0 to keep up their incredible season of overperformance, staying ahead of Lazio to remain in fifth place. We talked about guys like Frank Kessie, but and also Gomez, Alejandro Gomez. Atalanta. Story of the season in Italy, you could say.
Oh, yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's rare for a team to... Italy have like a top six of clubs that are just sort of impenetrable, that have been there since like the 90s. And yeah, for Atalanta to break into that is incredible. Alejandro Gomez is having a really sensational season. You look at the way he's playing and you're thinking, okay, he's not going to be there next season. That someone in Italy, one of the big clubs, is going to snap him up.
I think we picked him out as one of our best value signings to sign in the summer. So, not going to both squawker ahead of the head of the...
they're going to have a proper war chest in the summer. It'll be fascinating to see who they go and sign, because they've got kind of three or four players who could go for 25 big million plus. Money. So, yeah. Are Atalanta starting to have 100 million quid to spend or 100 million euros to spend in the summer? That'd be exciting.
It would. It definitely would. Meanwhile, Dzeko bagged his 16th goal of the campaign in Roma's 4-1 win over Torino. Sinisia Mihailovic claimed that goalkeeper Joe Hart was not at fault for any of the goals conceded. He just couldn't do anything. The quality of the finishing was too good. Roma's still up in the race, although they're still a bit behind Juventus, who obviously won to keep the distance going. But the current top scorers in Spain now, current top scorers in Spain, Italy and Germany now are all ex-Premier League strikers in Suarez, Dzeko and Anthony Modesta. Does that say anything, or is it just a coincidence, George?
Well, I think you can't really give Modest much of a...
Oh, we're going to.
I mean, he was on loan at Blackburn for I think, 3 or 4 months and got more red cards than goals.
But what did he learn from England to become such a great striker, George?
It's basically because the Premier League is probably the second biggest draw of a league in the world, so it's just natural that good players are going to play here.
They come and go. They come through.
Suarez was the Premier League was his stepping stone to La Liga, where he wanted to be the biggest, the best competition, whatever. And Dzeko, I think Dzeko was just unfairly let go by City. To be honest, I think Dzeko's fantastic footballer, and they're really
compared to Bonny, and it's just like
they really undervalued Dzeko's contribution, not just to City as a whole, but to Aguero playing football. When Dzeko plays with Aguero finds it much easier to do everything.
He linked up well with Silva as well, I always thought. Yeah, his movement was very intelligent.
He and Yaya Toure were the driving forces behind their 2014 title win when Aguero was injured constantly throughout the running. He was really good for City. I don't know why they, let him go back so easily. He didn't really fight to keep him. I always thought he would have been priority one, really.
Two-footed as well. Maybe he would have done well under Pep.
He would have been a fantastic forward for Pep. You look at him and Lewandowski, exactly that kind of forward.
Moving on now to Ligue 1. Intrigue in the title race and on the sidelines. Nice won 1-0 while both Monaco and PSG stalled with draws, keeping Jardim's high-scoring team at the top. But now Nice, as well as PSG, are just 3 points behind them. However, Mario Balotelli was sent off for a third time this season for Lucien Favre's team for a comment at the referee. He was given a rating of one by L'Equipe, only the 12th player since 1998 to be given a one rating. He scored 8 in his first 8 for the club. Everyone thought he was back. Super Mario's finally here. But now it all seems to have fallen apart. Favre said he's not working hard in training. His teammates have fallen out of him. Steve Williams back again says, "What do you make of Mario Balotelli's season at Nice? Showing both sides of his game. Brilliance 1 minute, madness the next. Is this the end of his career at the top level?"
Well, I not quite sure if I agree that he's shown much brilliance there. That run of goals at the beginning of the season, a few of them are penalties, which obviously still count, but I don't know if you call that brilliance. I think consistently all season, he's been outshadowed by some of Nice's other main talents, and just because he is a big name there, or at least he was a big name there.
It's a Ben Arthur narrative, isn't it? Like,
yeah, well, I just think that people looked at that team that were doing well and saw one name that they recognised and saw a couple of goals next to his name. But he hasn't been the key player for that team all season.
Mm. Well, the only reason why he actually played this weekend is because Plea was out injured.
Exactly, so. And it just surprised me that Favre, who's someone who we know from his time at Mönchengladbach, doesn't take prisoners lightly. So I'm surprised he's still in the squad, to be fair, and I think maybe that'll be the end of Balotelli's time at Nice.
Meanwhile, on the sidelines, as I said, Marcelo Bielsa has been announced as Lille's next manager and will take charge in the summer.
Hallelujah.
Absolutely. After the current season has come to an end. It's been said that the English Premier League, with Pep, Klopp and all the rest of them, Conte as well, has become a honeypot for elite managers. But with the likes of Bielsa, Favre, Garcia, Jardim, Emery and Koumoubaré as well, could the French top flight now be the next like great big arena for the up-and-coming elite managers in the game?
I think so. And one thing the Ligue 1 has always been slept on is it's very tactical. They're very well-organised teams. And now that PSG aren't Zlatanified, so they're not indestructible, although maybe they'll return to being that way next season, I don't know. But they've certainly been mortal this season, learning Emery's practices. I think Ligue 1 could become very competitive, very interesting next few years. As long as Nice don't get absolutely strip-mined for their best players, and Monaco too. But then I suppose Monaco.
Hey, Lille are coming up now by the sounds of it.
Well, but also, I mean, they've shown over the last couple of years that their recruitment policies, both Monaco and Nice's, is very, very good. Mm. So if they do get the money to reinvest, then that could be a good thing for them. I think what's important is that a lot of people who don't watch much Ligue 1 or don't follow it too much will look at, you know, the likes of Monaco, and they'll see them playing at City, and they're going to expect City to roll them over. But I'd implore people to reevaluate that, because they'll give them a very good game, I'd have thought.
Which brings us to the Champions League in midweek. Tuesday sees Manchester City host Monaco. Evil Hassie on Twitter asks, is it just me, or has Pep slowly sorted out his defence? And what do you guys think is the reason why it's improving? That's going to be key against Monaco, because as people may know, they scored 76 goals in 26 league games this season already. Are they Pep's nightmare? How's he going to stop that?
They're Pep's nightmare. The reason he sorted out his defence is because he sorted out his midfield and his forward line. He now has actual wingers that are playing well. He's no longer playing De Bruyne wide and messing around with that. He has De Bruyne and Silva in the middle of the park. His team is dominating the ball. It's owning the ball in high areas. They're creating goal threats. When Pep's team...
But even when he's been playing well, pace... You remember Theo Walcott for Arsenal back when he was at Barcelona?
I'm going to get to that. The point is, he sorted out his defence because he sorted out his attack. When Pep's teams can't score goals or aren't consistently a goal threat, they become very easy because his defence is high, it's exposed, and if his team doesn't own the ball and threaten the opponent just sends bodies forwards and crucifies his team defensively. Monaco, I mean, this thing, I think against Monaco, he will look to own the ball. That's how he'll defend. He'll go high, he'll go fast, he'll look to have the ball and keep Monaco pressed in. But Monaco, if they're fearless enough, if they're brave enough, and I think the recent evidence suggests they are brave enough, they will fly at him regardless of how much Pep has the ball, because I think, obviously Pep's defenders need to be able to do one-on-one duels very well, and I don't know if any of their defenders are really there yet. They have no fullbacks. Their fullbacks are terrible. They've got John Stones, who's obviously talented, but he's not quite there yet. Otamendi is their only defender who you could say consistently will win one-on-one duels.
And even he is really rash.
And he's erratic. Monaco with Bernardo Silva, Thomas Lemar, Kylian Mbappe even off the bench, they could really rip City to bits on the break.
I mean, I think that Fernandinho playing in this inverted fullback role has been a massive part of their improved success over the past two games, because it means that we know that Yaya Toure has talents, most of them on the ball, but in that holding midfield role, he can look so exposed when teams are playing at him, coming hard at him, with Fernandinho being able to come inside, he can help him out with the legwork. He can be that kind of scrapper in midfield when they don't have the ball, the balls are out wide, whilst also having the kind of energy and the tenacity to get back into position. But having said that, I think that if Man City don't win this game, they'll go out. I can't see them beating Monaco away from home. So this is an absolutely huge, huge game for Pep.
We talked about a few of the players there, but are there any specific players you think are going to really be the individuals to smash Pep's system?
I think Bakayoko and Fabinho in the centre midfield. I mean, a lot's written about Lamar and Silva, and rightly so. They're so, so impressive. But I remember in the Spurs games, in the group stages, those two just didn't give Spurs a second.
Bakayoko especially.
Bakayoko is an absolute, you know, he's a monster in midfield. He's so athletic, he's so strong. And on the ball, you know, he's not just a clogger. He's very talented passer. He's a really good runner. I think that those two will have way, way too much for Touré if he's exposed in that midfield engine room. Like, they will completely dominate him. I'm very positive Monaco's chances. If I was a City fan, I'd be concerned.
So look out. Look out, Pep. Tuesday also sees Leverkusen versus Atletico. Atletico thrash Gijon 4-1 away, with Kevin Gamero getting a hat-trick. In 5 minutes, indeed. While Leverkusen won 3-1 away to Augsburg. Not always the easiest fixture to deal with in the Bundesliga. Given his five-minute hat-trick, will the Frenchman start over Torres, or is Torres going to be the one that Simeone sticks with?
I would imagine he will start, but I mean, there might be something to be said for keeping him on the bench, using him as a late game super sub, because he's got so much pace. I mean, his hat trick was the fastest hat trick in La Liga by 1 second. It broke the previous record.
Wow!
You know, it's it was an incredible hat trick. He's a really talented striker. If he can get it all together, that's really going to help Atletico. Atletico, really, the Champions League is their only hope of winning anything now. Simeone's obsessed with winning it after losing two finals in 3 years to Real Madrid. I think they'll really go all out. I think Barcelona getting dumped out helps them. I think they have a chance. They have a chance if they can put it together. Leverkusen, obviously, a very good pressing side, but tendency to sort of let it slip in the big moments. I think Atletico win this.
Well, they've had unsteady form in the domestic competitions so far this season, have Leverkusen. Do you reckon they'll be able to translate the stronger side of their game to Europe, George, against Atletico? I mean, Simeone is a manager well used to dealing and defanging pressing teams, but a Schmidt side, when they do press, it's quite extreme, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think that when this draw was made, Diego Simeone would have given him a little fist pump. I think this is what he's made his career out of, is looking at these teams who play with a high press and working out the chinks in their armour and finding a way to break them. And I think he'll, with Atleti out of the title race, and the likelihood being that Simeone will leave at the end of the season, these games are what it's all about for him now. And kind of similar to Emery in a way, with the Barcelona game, I expect him to put absolutely everything into this, and I agree with Mo that they'll run out winners.
Sevilla host Leicester City on Wednesday. Leicester look absolutely listless. Their strongest 11 can't get results. They were beaten 1-0 by Millwall, despite the Lions having 10 men, as you said, for almost a full half of football in the FA Cup. Is this just a case of how big a score Sevilla can run up? Porto pummeled Leicester 5-0.
Yeah, no, this is basically... the funniest thing is, when this draw was made, we were all thinking, okay, stylistically, Leicester are actually a really good match for Sevilla. That could be interesting. But since that draw has been made, Leicester's form, it was already bad. It's just gone to terrible. It's super bad. You know, it's just awful. And they look like they're going to go down, frankly. And I think they will. I think they're going to get absolutely hammered by Sevilla. Unless, and I will say this, remember when we all thought they were dead in the water and they beat City 4-1, whatever it was, because they targeted a weak player in defence, or they went after it and they played very, very fast, very direct to Jamie Vardy. If they do that against Sevilla, Sampdoria's a very brave man, plays with a very high line of defence, they could... There's just a small chance that Leicester from last season could come out. It's very small. I don't think it'll happen. I think Sevilla are going to just batter them. Sami Nasri and Steven Ndonsi are going to own the ball. I think... they're just going to deny the service to Vardy, and they're just going to, as long as Sevilla's finishing holds up, you know, big onus on Vieto and the like, and Sarabia. Yeah, as long as the finishing can hold up, I think Sevilla will win this comfortably.
Also on Wednesday, Porto hosts Juventus, which could be a better, more balanced match for those who want to actually watch a football match rather than a one-sided battering.
I'd implore people who haven't seen Sampdoria Sevilla play before to tune in and watch
that. Yes, absolutely.
Fair enough. But Porto have got to go for broke, though, to get a few goals scored at home, because as Steve Williams again off Twitter tweeted, will any team get a result against Juventus? They're on a ridiculous run of results at home.
Yeah, an elite side will get a result against Juventus, basically.
Porto elite enough?
No.
I think they're pretty impenetrable at home. So I'd be surprised to see. I still think, I agree with you, Greg. I know we've spoken about before that Juve are one of the favourites to win this.
Well, they're kind of a heavyweight with the fewest questions hanging over them.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, home form is so important in the Champions League. And then, you know, they're just there. I'd have Real Madrid as being the only team I could see them giving massive problems. I think they'd beat Bayern.
And just one thing to say on Porto, they're one of two Portuguese sides in the Champions League round of 16. Benfica, the other one, who are currently 1-0 up at halftime in their tie against Dortmund. And what does he say about the Portuguese league, the quality of players, the scouting networks, the coaching coming through? Are they rising again? Or is it just a one-off year?
I mean, I don't think Porto will ever be what they were, where they became like the hit factory for years. They just produced great player after great player after great player.
Benfica were getting there, though.
Benfica have been rising, and supporting Portugal shouldn't be discounted, although they're not quite there yet. I don't know. It's hard to say if the Portuguese league is rising, because it really just does rise and fall depending on the quality of their scouting. Because those three clubs, they scour South America for these young up and coming talents. They sign them, they develop them, and then they sell them. So maybe they're in a rising moment to develop their next bunch of signings that they're going to sell in 3-4 years. I don't know. It's hard to say, really.
Maybe a few of them could be on their way to Old Trafford, as they often are. Because on Wednesday night also, we used to see Thursday night Europa League, but Wednesday night sees St Etienne host Man United in the second leg of their Europa League tie. 3-0 up from the first leg. United may have a chance to rest players ahead of their EFL Cup final match against Southampton at the weekend.
I don't think they'll rest that many players. I think St Etienne is going to be a raucous atmosphere. They showed at Old Trafford that they're no pushovers. I think maybe Zlatan will get a rest, and that might be it. I think everyone else is going to be forced in. Pogba's definitely going to play. I think.
Well, Rashford scored when he started at the weekend, yeah, so
And then people are saying that Paul Scholes said on BT Sport that Zlatan shouldn't even go to St Etienne next week. I think Zlatan's going to go, because I think St Etienne are not. I think 3-0 down, okay, fine. But then what if St Etienne score an early goal, score two early goals? Their crowd is going to be incredible. You need Zlatan's leadership. Forget his football to it. You need him on the bench being like, hey, calm down, guys. Zlatan will be there. I think he'll be on the bench. I think everyone else will be mostly full strength. Not to discredit Southampton or anything, but I think United will think, okay, look, we can beat Southampton if we're played. It's on a Wednesday as well. You know, it's back in the old Champions League rhythm, which many footballers have said it's just easier to deal with. You know, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, Sunday. So I think he'll be relatively strong team. I don't think he'll rotate too much.
I think the only thing I'd say is maybe Zlatan will go and start and then get hooked early on, because all they need is one goal and then it's tie over.
Yeah. Well, one player that could also start, he didn't start the weekend, even though some people expect he might do, is Luke Shaw. El Harazi asked, what is his current situation? We described it on the pod last week with Stobes, what was going on a bit there. Mourinho has since insisted he's not going anywhere, he's not going to sell Luke Shaw, which kind of contrasts with how he spoke about Schneiderlin Depay. Do you expect him to start against San Etienne?
Well, I thought he'd start yesterday against Blackburn as well. There's something going on. I mean, I know he asks what's going on. We don't know what's going on, effectively. Mourinho spoke about his injury again over the weekend, which suggests that there may be something mental there, that he thinks he's not quite ready for battle at the moment. It's hard to know. He's 21 years old. He's so young. It feels like this should be the kind of game where he'd play him, but you know, who are we to second guess Jose?
I don't think Jose will sell him. I think I agree with him, because purely because he is 21 years old. If he comes good, he's a fantastic player. Mourinho's not going to hand, and he's not going to go abroad. Mourinho's not going to hand a player like Luke Shaw to one of his rivals.
I'm speaking of the other end of the career. Michael Carrick is clearly coming to the end of his days as a player. Sherry Joshua asks, who's the best man to replace him? Do you reckon he'll be rested for the EFL, to play for the EFL Cup final?
One, no, I think he's going to play 4-2-3-1 in the EFL Cup final. And two, Daley Blind. Or if you're going to sign someone, Julian Weigl. But I think Daley Blind. I think Daley Blind he started his life as a defence midfielder. He's clearly not got the pace to play fullback.
Seems to be an exile of late, though, doesn't he?
He's playing left back just because Mourinho hates Luke Shaw so much. But I mean, I think you put Daley Blind defensive field, I think that's a ready-made carrot replacement.
I think he wants to play the bit holding to his Herrera and Pogba with Mkhitaryan at 10. I don't think he should, but I think that's what he wants to do.
Or with Griezmann at 10. We've had a question as well from Ender Higgins asking, what formation will United line up in next season with all these rumours of who else are going to sign?
Well, yeah, I think if they don't sign anyone, it will be 4-2-3-1, as I just said, with Mkhitaryan playing centrally. If they do sign Griezmann, then good luck, Jose, because I don't know how he's going to fit in.
I mean, it's there's options, isn't it? If sign Griezmann, there's options. You've got 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3. You can play Mkhitaryan wide left, wide right. Play Griezmann wide right, central, up front by himself. Zlatan's going to be 1 year older. Surely he can't play every game again next season. So there's options to play. I think 4-2-3-1 and 4-2-3 will remain Jose Mourinho's main go-tos.
Thursday sees Spurs take on Ghent in the Europa League as well. Pochettino's side, unlike United, are 1-0 down from the first leg. They look a different side in Europe and not in a good way. They also don't travel very well against the top six, as we well know. But what's the problem, George?
It's just so hard to know, really. They just don't seem to play well on their travels in Europe. I don't know if it's a lack of experience in playing in Europe, or maybe it's experience, but all the experiences are bad, so they've just got a mental block when it gets there. The win against Fulham will definitely help. But this is a massive, massive game for them, for me, because it could be their last Wembley fixture before they go there next season. And they need to sort this Wembley block out, because this could be a massive issue for them. They're so, so poor there. They completely lose home advantage. So for that reason, they really need to, you know, smash someone at Wembley.
Well, it might not be their last Wembley fixture this season. No. Ollie Young-Miles asks, podcast regular, Ole Gunnar asks, would it be better for Spurs to win the FA Cup and finish fifth, or secure top four and extend the trophy drought if there is no, you know, glory to be had in the Europa League?
Win a trophy. Always win a trophy. As Ollie himself has said, Spurs need to stop talking about winning and actually do some winning. They absolutely need to win. It would be transformative, frankly, for a lot of these Spurs players to win a trophy. They're also young. They're also, well, not Vertonghen and Alderweireld, but, you know, a lot of them are young. They've not really won a thing before, a lot of them. Only, you know, again, Alderweireld and Vertonghen have won things. Yeah, they need, if they can actually go and win an FA Cup, and it'll be a hard run as well, they're probably going to end up playing Arsenal or something in the semi-final. If they can win an FA Cup, you know, that would be huge. It would give them belief, and then suddenly then they can mount a title challenge. Maybe they won't wilt under pressure all the time.
I think top four.
Ooh.
But just because it's, you know, if they don't win the FA, if they win the FA Cup and they finish outside top four, then they've got to deal with the Europa League next season. That makes it so hard to progress.
Fair enough. Interesting points. Other interesting ties to be decided in the Europa League this week sees Athletic Club against Apoel. They won 3-2 at home in the first leg, but I mean that's a very slim margin of goals to take away to Cyprus. Legia Warsaw 0-0 against Ajax in the first leg of their game. They had a shock 2-0 loss at the weekend, whereas Ajax won against Vitesse 1-0. So, you know, Ajax going to have the home advantage, probably going to see them go through. Celta Vigo travel away to Shakhtar Donetsk, who are already 1-0 up with an away goal from their first leg. So, you know, we talk about weird home advantage, Donetsk, they can't play their moments. Gladbach take on Fiorentina, going away to Fiorentina, who also have the away goal from the first leg. Roma, meanwhile, are all but through after beating Villarreal 4-0 away from home in the first leg. Probably going to be a competition to lose if none of the English clubs can step up to take them on. But that is all we have time for this week on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Mo, thank you for coming on.
My pleasure, Greg.
Thank you very much, George, for joining us once again.
Cheers, Greg.
No problem. Do join us again soon. We're going to have another podcast on Wednesday. And Nick English will be back on Friday morning, I believe, to look at all the weekend's action to come. So please do join us again. And thanks for listening.